This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte.
A Purdue University Northwest professor in the Hammond campus has put out a new book that is one of interest that if you happen to remember when Mitch Daniels was the governor of Indiana, how he was involved in this. And Professor David Detmer is with us to talk about his book, which is now out to be checked out. And Professor Detmer, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, tell us a little bit about... Tell us, if you will, about the title of the book, Xenophobia, The Battle Over History and Education, Politics, and Scholarship. And how does that happen to bring a person named Howard Zinn together with Mitch Daniels?
Okay. The way this happened, back in 2013, there was a reporter for the Associated Press who did a Freedom of Information Act search of the emails of Mitch Daniels from when he had been governor. And he came upon an email that Mitch Daniels put out when Howard Zinn died. And for people who are not familiar with Howard Zinn, he was a historian who wrote a best-selling book called A People's History of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, in Mitch Daniels' email, he said, I think that's a terrible book. I don't think it should be used for credit anywhere in the state of Indiana. In fact, I'm going to quote directly. I'm looking at the email right now.
Okay.
He said, can someone assure me that it is not in use anywhere in Indiana? If it is, how do we get rid of it before more young people are force-fed a totally false version of our history? And so I got interested in this, and I started researching it. And one of the things Mitch Daniels did to justify his action was to say, well, you don't have to take my word for it that Howard Zinn was a bad historian who wrote a bad book. There are a number of historians and other scholars who say the same. And so I started reading and researching their work, and I found that it was just larded with errors. They would misquote Zinn. They would say, well, he never says X when he really does say X. Just lots and lots of mistakes. And so the title of the book is just a pun on his name. Xenophobia with an X is, you know, fear of foreigners, essentially. And so I then took Zinn's name, Xenophobia, to reflect the attitude of Mitch Daniels and these other scholars. And there was this sort of battle over this particular book.
What did people seem to feel was wrong, and in particular, I guess, Mitch Daniels, about Howard Zinn's book, The People's History of the United States?
Yeah, what was different about Zinn's book is traditional American history books tend to very much glorify the deeds of our presidents and military leaders and business leaders. And I think from Zinn's point of view, they had something of a patriotic bias, you might say, not willing to fully confront the bad side of our history. And so in Zinn's work, it's called A People's History, and I guess there are really sort of two sides to that. One is wanting to acknowledge the suffering sometimes that the ordinary people had endured at the hands of these leaders. That's number one. And then number two, the book makes an argument that significant progress has tended to be initiated from below by the people rather than from the top by presidents and so on. But back to the first point, just to give an illustration, the first chapter of Zinn's book is about Columbus, and he quotes from Columbus's journal. Now, I don't have this right in front of me, so I'm paraphrasing,
No. But
in Columbus's journal, he says things like the Arawak people that he had met. He says, oh, they're handsome people, they're friendly, they're generous, they're eager to share everything they have. With 50 men, we could subjugate the whole lot of them and enslave the entire island. And in Zinn's account, it proceeds to talk about how Columbus enslaved Indians and killed many of them who didn't give him enough gold and so on. And people like Mitch Daniels are offended by that. They see it as anti-American. So I think that's sort of the main criticism that people have had of Zinn's work.
Has it been the case where, as you say, it's just one person's opinion or maybe a group of people's opinion against Howard Zinn and then the way that he put that book together?
Oh, yes, Mitch Daniels is far from alone. So I think it's fair to say that many people who identify with the conservative wing of American political opinion, they tend to prefer a more quote-unquote patriotic approach to history, so they tend not to like it. And then among professional historians, it's a little bit different. And one of the things that Mitch Daniels said in defending himself is he said, hey, it's not just people on the right, conservatives, who have criticized Zinn. There are people of other political persuasions who have done so as well. And he's right about that. And I think their part of the explanation is not so much political conservatism as professional conservatism. And what I mean by that is historians have been trained. There's a certain way to do history. There are certain subjects you tend to emphasize and other things you de-emphasize. And Zinn was doing it differently than, you know, the role models they learned when they were in graduate school. So it sort of looked wrong. It looked as if Zinn had an axe to grind. And so I think that's part of why they criticized it. But I do want to emphasize that although Zinn has many critics, he also has a great many admirers, including among professional historians. He's gotten a lot of praise from some historians and won some awards and things of that nature. And that book is a phenomenal publishing success. It sold over 2 million copies, and that's very rare for a history book.
In fact, you mentioned one of his greatest supporters, and there's a quote that's in the book here from author Noam Chomsky. He's an amazing person in his own right, too.
Yes, he is. Noam Chomsky, for people not familiar with him, he's a linguist from MIT and often considered to be the most important figure in that discipline in history. He really revolutionized the discipline. And he's also, you might say, a polymath, someone who's made important contributions to many fields. My field, incidentally, is philosophy. I'm a professor of philosophy, and Chomsky is very highly regarded among philosophers. He's done very important work in that field. He's done important work in mathematics, computer science. He's quite an amazing figure.
We're talking with David Detmer. He's a professor of philosophy, as you just mentioned, at Purdue University Northwest in Hammond. He's been on the faculty there at the Hammond campus since 1989, and he has just written another book, and this one is entitled Xenophobia, The Battle Over History and Education, Politics, and Scholarship. What's interesting is that you mentioned then-governor, now former governor, and now Purdue University president, Mitch Daniels. At the time that he was governor, he was very much against Zinn's book, and I guess made some very concerted efforts to be sure that it was banned in Hoosier schools, I understand.
That is correct. And so, those emails, as I mentioned, have been published, and he did instruct his subordinates to look into this. And what he ended up, there was a kind of back and forth with his subordinates, and they ended up saying, we should do, I'm looking at it right now, we should undertake a review of university courses across the state. This would, quote, force to daylight a lot of excrement. And then Daniels replied, go for it, disqualify propaganda. So they had this whole exchange where they talked about trying to in some way make sure the book was not being used for credit. Now, as it turns out, once this was exposed, I think Mitch Daniels was a bit embarrassed because most of the national publicity was negative. The thought was, you know, this is censorship. It's not really appropriate for a governor to be interfering with educational decisions about which books are being used. And so here's an interesting thing about it. He then claimed that the articles in the press had misrepresented his emails. He said, I wasn't talking about the university. I was only talking about K-12 education. Yes, at the university, professors can teach anything they want. But when you look at the actual emails, it's hard to sustain that interpretation. Because he starts out, he quotes from an obituary that says that Zinn's book is, quote, the textbook of choice in high schools and colleges around the country. And then Daniel says, Can someone assure me that it is not in use anywhere in Indiana? And he doesn't say anything about, you know, K through 12 as opposed to the university. And then when one of his subordinates comes back and says, well, I've gone online and I've found that it's being used in a course at Indiana University, then Daniel says, well, we can't have that. We've got to disqualify that. So it appears that his claim that he was only talking about K through 12 is not true. The actual emails do not sustain that interpretation.
Now you go now to 2018. We have former Governor Mitch Daniels, now the president of Purdue University. What's, as far as we know, his current thinking about Mr. Howard Zinn and about his book, People's History of the United States?
I don't think he has commented on it in recent years. Mm-hmm. When the controversy came out, as I say, he tried to make this claim. He was not talking about the university. So he said things like, if anybody at Purdue wants to teach Howard Zinn, I won't interfere with it. And if Howard Zinn were a faculty member at Purdue, I would let him pursue his research without interfering with him, and so on. So he said all of those things when this whole story was exposed. But to my knowledge, he hasn't really addressed the controversy since then. There was, at that time, there were some professors at the West Lafayette campus who wrote an open letter to more or less protest what Daniels had done, and he wrote a kind of reply to that, and in that reply he made some of these points I've mentioned, claiming he wasn't talking about the university. But to my knowledge, he hasn't commented on Howard Zinn since then.
Well, I'm sure he'll probably want to see a copy of your book. He probably should take a look at them. Maybe Mr. Daniels won't.
Maybe. Who knows? I'm not sure what his reading habits are, but yeah.
Maybe Mr. Daniels won't, because he's already gone through that phase of his life, and he probably doesn't want to live that again, I would imagine so.
That's quite possible.
Professor David Detmer of the Purdue University Northwest Campus in Hammond is a professor of philosophy, and he's also the author of another book. He's written four other books before, but his latest book is entitled Xenophobia, The Battle Over History and Education, Politics, and Scholarship. And also, too, by the way, he serves as the current chairman of the Purdue University Northwest Faculty Senate. And Professor Detmer, thank you very much for being with us to talk about your book. And hope that a lot of people do manage to get a copy of it. If they have not known about Howard Zinn, learn something about the man, about his philosophy, and why it seemed to raise so many hairs on the back of Mitch Daniels' neck, apparently, when he learned about it the first time it came around. Thank you for being with us to talk about it today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And Indiana law allows police to seize thousands of dollars worth of property if they think it's involved in a suspected crime, regardless of whether the person who owns it is ever convicted. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier reports the country's highest court is set to hear a challenge to one aspect of that civil forfeiture law later this year.
When Tyson Timms moved in with his aunt in Marion a few years ago, he hoped it would be a fresh start.
I actually thought, hey, maybe this is going to be the cure to all my problems. Unfortunately, I came with me. So, you can't run from yourself.
Tim says he was hooked on prescription painkillers, something he struggled with for years. Then he turned to heroin. He used some life insurance money from his father's death to fuel his habit. And he also used part of the payout to buy a more than $42,000 Land Rover. Court documents say Timms drove that car to Richmond to buy heroin. And at least twice, he sold the drug for a total of about $500.
I'd ran out of my life insurance money, and I didn't want to be sick. I had a little bit one day. And a guy called and said, I have some people that, want to buy some dope. And I took the chance.
But the buyer was an undercover detective. Police eventually arrested Timms and took his Land Rover. A couple months after the state filed felony charges against Timms, it also started a civil forfeiture case in an attempt to keep his car. That was 5 years ago. Timms is still trying to get his Land Rover back.
It's been tough. A lot of it is, it might sound silly, but it hurts my self-esteem. I'm a grown man that doesn't have his own vehicle.
While he pleaded guilty to one of the drug deals, Timms fought the forfeiture. He doesn't think police should be able to seize a car worth tens of thousands of dollars for a low-level drug offense. His attorney says that violates the Eighth Amendment's excessive fines clause. The trial court ruled in Timms's favor, saying the vehicle was worth more than four times the maximum penalty he could face in criminal court. And the Indiana Court of Appeals also sided with Timms. That ruling says the seizure was disproportionate to the gravity of the crime. But the Indiana Supreme Court took a different stance. Wesley Hoddit is an attorney with the Institute for Justice and represents Timms. He was stunned by the court's reasoning.
The Indiana Supreme Court took the state's appeal and decided, to everyone's surprise, that the excessive fines clause of the U.S. Constitution does not apply in this state, meaning that the state could take Tyson's vehicle, and meaning, in fact, that the state could take any Huser's property for even a minor crime.
That's something the U.S. Supreme Court will now have to decide after it hears the case later this year. But most civil forfeiture cases don't get nearly as far. It's hard to put an exact number on how many cases go undisputed because until this year, the state didn't require counties to report those activities. Lewis Ruley is an expert on civil forfeiture at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. He says more often than not, the seizures go unchallenged.
If you seize $1,000 but it costs you $3,000 to get it back, nobody in their right mind is going to fight. They're going to give up.
And that's not the only barrier for Hoosiers who want their property back. The seizures are handled separately from criminal proceedings in civil court. Ruley says that means there's no right to an appointed attorney if a defendant can't afford one.
And that's a very troubling notion, that people are losing their property, not because they're guilty of some illegal activity, but because it's either too costly or too difficult, too complex, too time-consuming to fight back.
Hearing those kinds of stories is what motivates Timms to continue his fight.
It's not about getting my truck back, you know, for me. That hasn't been the case for me for a long time. For me, this is principle. You know, they shouldn't be able to do this to people.
In the years since police took his car, Tim says he's made a lot of changes. He's now clean and even speaks to local and state task forces about his battle with addiction and the criminal justice system. And he has a job, but he has to borrow his Aunt Wendy's car to get there while she takes a bus to dialysis.
We don't all have an Aunt Wendy, so there's a lot of people like me that they're stuck.
It's those people Tim says he'll be thinking of as the Supreme Court hears his case. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
That case will come up, by the way, before the U.S. Supreme Court in November or December, and it's one of several legal challenges to Indiana's civil forfeiture laws. Tomorrow, we'll take a closer look at where the money goes when property is seized and sold. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. With us now in studio is Northwest Indiana political activist Ruth Needleman. And Ruth, welcome to the program, as always.
Thank you. I love it.
One of the things that we want to mention first off here is a very important program coming up on the IU Northwest campus tomorrow evening, Tuesday the 11th. It's going to be at 6:30 in the evening. It's going to be on in the campus in the auditorium in the Savannah Center. It's a program, I understand, is a public forum, I guess the title of which is The Politics of Immigration and Racism. Tell us about the creation of this forum and who all is involved.
Okay, well, we decided that we needed an old-fashioned teach-in because there are so many complications and little hidden corners in the immigration debate. And we wanted to be able to, one, answer questions that people have about what is the legal path, why isn't it working, why are these people coming, and what, in fact, have been the changes in U.S. policy. So we put together an incredible crew, I would say, of people to talk about this very complicated situation. Because, as you know, continued family separation still exists. There was just a report let out yesterday by ProPublica on the detention centers for children in the Chicago area. And they've held people for up to 590 days. These are children. And I won't even go into the conditions because I was appalled. But anyhow, not only are the family separations continuing, but they happen every Friday at the Gary Airport because the deportations for Illinois, Wisconsin, Indiana, and Kentucky leave from our airport except on those days when we protest. Mm-hmm. And we have learned that on those days, because we always let them know we're coming, they divert the buses to O'Hare. And right now there's a big battle going on in Kankakee over whether to expand both the jail and the airport in Kankakee. It seems that Illinois uses our airport as a reliever, but they want to make sure we don't make too much money. And when things look profitable, they go back over to the Illinois side of the border. But anyhow, the deportations have been increasing. People are being picked up for virtually no reason. And I would imagine some of our listeners have heard that U.S. citizens, children of U.S. citizens, third-generation U.S. citizens, are being denied passports even though they present a birth certificate because they are of Mexican heritage. Now, of course, the entire southwest of the United States used to be part of Mexico. So being of Mexican heritage makes them more American than any of the people who immigrated here after 1600. But anyhow, they're also, the present administration is avoiding dealing with the DACA situation where hundreds of thousands of children brought to this country before the age of 16, many of them as infants, grew up in this country and have jobs, have gotten college educations, are contributing through taxes and businesses. They are subject to deportation, and Trump has been trying to deport them, although the courts keep blocking that effort. So anyhow, our purpose is to educate, clarify, and also frame this information in a historical context. In other words, why the immigrants come here and why they come from certain countries. Mm-hmm. And so let me first tell you who's on the panel.
Yes, and looking at the list here, it's quite a blue ribbon panel.
It is an exceptional panel. We have Sister Joanne Persh. This is a Sister of Mercy who has been meeting with the people and their families who are on those deportation buses for over 12 years. And so more than anyone else I have come across, including anyone in the administration, she actually knows the stories of the people being deported, and she knows their families. And most of them she knows have been here over 20 or 30 years. And so this is kind of a rude awakening, but she will be there to share her stories and what she knows about the people. Then we have Fred Saul, who is the chief policy analyst for the Illinois Coalition on Immigrant and Refugee Rights. And he has been following the policy changes. He knows the history of U.S. policy, and he will talk about that. But he also has been the person from Chicago who has worked with every attempt to prevent GEO, the private prison company, from building a prison around here. Mm-hmm. And we have won, may I say, so far we're 7-7. But GEO is back in Roselawn trying to build a prison near Fair Oaks Farm, and they want an 800-bed prison for immigrants, which means they intend to sweep up quite a few if they can. And then, in addition to that, we have Jose Bustos. He has been a union organizer, a community activist, and he has just received a sizable grant from the Legacy Foundation to begin a program called Esperanza, Hope, in East Chicago, which will provide legal and other services to immigrant families who are desperately in need and also desperately afraid. One of the biggest problems he has run into in the past couple of years is the children of immigrants are afraid to go to school. Not only because they're afraid they might get picked up, but they're afraid they'll come home and their parents won't be there. And so the level of trauma, the level of terror in the immigrant community is huge. So Jose will talk about that work. Mm-hmm. And then we have the top immigration lawyer, Alfredo Estrada, from Northwest Indiana. He has been handling, this is a change in the schedule, so that we even upped it further, we have the main immigrant attorney coming to talk about, so what are your rights if you're immigrants, and what do the rest of us need to know about the legal situation here? And following him, we have Laurel Kilpatrick from Black Lives Matter, also a disability advocate, works for Everybody Counts, and she will be talking about what we sometimes call intersectionality, the fact that our destiny, whether we are poor white, poor black, Latino, we are interconnected. And when the repression increases on one group, it has a ripple effect. So they build all these immigrant prisons. Who are they going to put in there when the deportations get cut back? Hey, it'll be young African-Americans. So Laurel will talk about that. And then yours truly, what would a panel be without Ruth? I'm going to do two things. First of all, I'm going to tell, what can you do? How can you get involved? We have a GoFundMe page right now, the NWI Resistance GoFundMe page is to enable us to put billboards up on 94 or the toll road that say, stop family separation, end the deportations at the Gary Airport. And we're doing quite well, but every dollar makes a big difference because if we only buy 1 month, it costs much more. So we are aiming for 3 months, and really we will talk about that. We're also planning for this coming Saturday, our next meeting, and that will be at 10 o'clock in the morning at Purdue Northwest campus in the Student Union Library Building in room 317. And we will talk about the billboards, the protests, the educationals, everything we think we need to do to support these children and families. Then I will also talk about what's going on here? Why are they coming in such large numbers? In my previous life, even before labor studies, I taught Latin American studies. And so I know the history of Latin America very well. And I was actually in Chile when the U.S. Funded and helped to coordinate a military takeover of the country of a democratically elected president. So many of the people that come here are fleeing forms of terror that are the result of U.S. foreign policy. We put in repressive governments because they're friendly to our corporations, and we put in military dictatorships if we don't like what the people vote for. Because many countries in Latin America are very suspicious of the United States. I think some of you might have read the New York Times this weekend that we've been meeting with the Venezuelan military minority who don't like their government and want to get help in overthrowing it. This is not what a country should be doing. If we don't like what's going on, we should make sure it doesn't happen here. But we have no right to intervene in other countries to overthrow democratically elected governments, which is what we have been doing for more than 100 years. So I will review some of that. There'll be plenty of time for questions and answers. And I think it's going to be well worth it.
Once again, this is a public forum that is entitled The Politics of Immigration and Racism. It's going to be held tomorrow evening, Tuesday evening, at 6:30 is when it begins. It'll be in the auditorium in the Savannah Center on the IU Northwest campus. And you can get more information, if you like, by going on to the NWI Resist Facebook page. It'll tell you there, too. Ruth Needleman, thank you, as always, for spending time with us. We hope tomorrow's event goes off very
can
well.
Can I make a couple other announcements?
Yes.
Okay. I've already mentioned the meeting that we're having on Saturday at 10 o'clock, but there's also going to be a meeting with a community group this Thursday at 2 o'clock, also at Purdue Northwest in room 307. This is a meeting with a group from D.C. that does national work on immigration, and they wanted to meet with us, and we would like to open this meeting at 2 p.m. to anyone who would like to go. And then I want to mention the upcoming South Shore Dance Alliance, because this is one of the most fabulous artistic programs that Northwest Indiana has put together. And I will be having Larry, who's the head of the dance, South Shore Dance Company, on my radio show this Thursday.
Oh, wonderful.
Yes. And then lastly, I don't know if there's any time left, I saw a fabulous musical this past weekend at Theater Wit in Chicago, and it's called Haymarket. And they actually tell, in song and dance, the entire story of the May Day events, the Haymarket events, and the trial. And I not only thought that it was brilliant and wonderful, it was hysterically funny. So if you can, check it out.
Okay.
Theater Wit. Up in Chicago.
Well, Ruth Needleman, thank you as always for popping in and giving us the update. And we look forward to the public forum that is going to be tomorrow evening at 6:30. It's going to be held in the auditorium at the Savannah Center on the IU Northwest campus. And thanks for joining us today to tell us about it.
Okay.
You're listening
don't
to
Reach.
Yes.
Don't forget that Can We Talk is opening on September 24th, our regionally based trauma healing center.
Oh, yes.
So have me back to talk about that.
We will. We will, to be sure. Thanks very much. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Lakeshore Public Radio, Sharon Jackson attended several shows at Ravinia Festival during its 2018 season, which included Alan Cummings' Legal Immigrant Show, Lost 80s Live, An Evening with Cake, and Ben Folds. And Culture Club's Boy George, the B-52s, and the Thompson Twins' Tom Bailey, also performing at Ravinia this year. And Sharon has a season wrap report.
The 2018 concert season at Ravinia is underway, and attendees are making the most of it. Lakeshore Public Radio so far has attended a handful of shows at the venue, including Alan Cummings' Legal Immigrant Show on Friday, July 13th. This season is Ravinia's comedy debut, as the venue is hosting stand-up comedian shows for the first time. Cumming put forth a lot of points during his Legal Immigrant Show, during the course of which he also mentioned advanced scrotal aging, somehow working that into the conversation. The show, to me, looked like cabaret meets stand-up, because he did a great job on lots of cabaret songs. He did a great job on an Adele song.
I heard that you settle down, that you found a girl, that you're married now.
He commented on the current political climate in the U.S. and how it's affecting immigration, how immigration is being treated by the current administration, and he also pointed out that the United States itself was built by immigrants. Cummings sang several songs that were written and performed by immigrants, including Jewish Americans and Scottish Americans, and made sure to drive that point home to the crowd. He also noted that he is a Scottish American, and he told the audience that 4 days after President Obama was elected, Cumming himself became a legal citizen of the United States. He also made sure to mention that President Trump's mother is an immigrant, and Trump himself is married to an immigrant. Then there was the Lost 80s Live show on Sunday, July 29th, in which 10 bands, including A Flock of Seagulls, Naked Eyes, Wayne Chung, Animotion, the original vocalists of When in Rome, UK, Farrington and Mann, New Shoes, and Dramarama, all performed their biggest hits that literally had the audience members out of their chairs.
Meet me in a restaurant. Meet me on the top of the world.
Each band did about a half-hour set, all sounding great, just like they did back in their heyday. And Emotion featured both original front people, Bill Wadhams and Astrid Plain. They mentioned their new album, which was released in 2017, called Raise Your Expectations. They performed a track from that album as well. New Shoes thanked the audience for keeping their music alive and sang their hits, including Point of No Return and I Can't Wait, among others. It was the band's first time performing at Ravinia. The show also included Gene Loves Jezebel, Christopher Anton, formerly of Information Society, and Trans X. As far as I could tell, the band stuck to the hits and kept it to that during each set. Members of Animotion and Dramarama went out into the audience area to meet and greet their fans as well.
Public radio is my thing, man. That's why I need public radio.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Let me say, hey, this is John Easdale. You're listening to Lakeshore Public Radio.
An Evening with Cake and Ben Folds was Wednesday, August 22nd.
Engines pumping and thumping in time.
Ben Folds had fans singing songs for him and spent much of the time standing while he was playing his piano. He performed songs, The Mean Streets of Highland Park, The Battle of Who Could Care Less, Levi Johnston's Blues, The Luckiest, Fred Jones Part 2, Rockin' the Suburbs, and Zach and Sarah, among others. Then Cake took the stage with their 13-song set, which included songs Frank Sinatra, Sinking Ship, Mexico, Meanwhile Rick James, Sick of You, Never There, and the encore song The Distance, which had everybody out of their chairs in the pavilion.
He's going the distance. He's going for speed.
When the band initially went on, Cake brought out a potted apple tree on stage and stood it right next to lead singer John McCrea for a portion of the show. Then McCrea made the audience guess what kind of tree it was. The band gave the tree away to a guy in the audience named Chris. McCrea told Chris to be sure to take good care of the tree, give it lots of shade, and send the band a picture of it every year, and be sure to follow through. An interesting intro to the encore song, lead singer McCrea came out on stage and said that they had better play fast because there's a hard curfew at Ravinia, because there are beautiful homes surrounding the venue. Beautiful homes full of hostility, he said.
He's fighting and fighting and riding on his horse. The sun has gone down and the moon has come up.
Ravinia kicked off the month of September with the Culture Club's Boy George, the B-52s, and Tom Bailey from the Thompson Twins. It was an 80s music fan's dream. The place was packed on Saturday night the 1st, and not even the buckets of rain that descended on Ravinia detracted the crowd that filled the lawn. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
It's time once again for Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Bridget Covert, the Director of Exhibitions at South Shore Arts, my colleague. Hello, Bridget.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, it's my pleasure. And of course, I actually do know what you're going to talk about, so that's a good thing. And that is the 75th anniversary of the Salon Show.
Yes.
It started in the ladies' hat department of Minas Department Store in 1936, but it didn't become annual until 1944. So we date it from 1944 as far as 75th annual,
which is a big deal, I feel like. So
yeah, it's a big milestone.
Yes.
And is this your
third? This is my third one.
Okay, yes. Third Salon Show. And why don't you tell us, this is it's a juried show.
Yes.
Artists submit entries and we have a juror.
Mm-hmm.
And why don't you tell us about the juror this year?
Yes, this year's juror is Sergio Gomez, who is the director at the Joby Art Center and a curator himself and an artist. And he's pretty great. And I think I just got the selections back from him yesterday and was looking through it. And it's going to be a really exciting show this year. The Salon Show is always one of my favorite shows just because it's such a variety of art. And
right.
There's just so many artists that get involved with it. And this year we had over 300 pieces submitted. So the work was cut out for Sergio, that's for sure. He chose 69 pieces. So out of 300, which is,
yeah.
I feel like that's a daunting task when you're looking at all that. And I mean, and there's so many good pieces every year. There's like, oh, I wish I would have got like that one would have got in, or I'm so glad that one got in, or you know, something like that. So, but it's a fun show to see.
This is Sergio was an interesting choice for the juror, especially for like a milestone event. when I, because we've always tried to find some people of prestige in the art world. The very first one I did was the 50th annual Salon Show, and when I started in 1993, and we had a woman who was a curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago, and but we've had curators, we've had gallery owners, we've had other artists. We had Richard Brower, who's the namesake for the Brower Museum of Art at VU. We've had people from of all different levels of involvement in the art world, some from Chicago, some from Indiana, maybe some from Michigan, I can't remember. But it's been, but Sergio's kind of interesting because we first met him, we used to do this show called the University Show, and I'm pretty sure that Sergio was the first winner, the winner of the very first one. And the artist, Ed Paschke, was our juror for that.
Oh, fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Sergio's kind of a fun choice, too, just because he's got roots in Indiana and in Chicago. So it's just kind of nice to have someone who balances both and is so involved with different, I don't know, groups of people. And he's really kind of an entrepreneur himself because he does all these lessons and he's very active on social media. And he does a lot of teaching with how to sell your art and how to get into a gallery. And he has like a little morning show he does on his Instagram that's really kind of fun to watch for artists. But he's got quite the realm of people that he's helped out.
Yeah, I would agree with you. He's very entrepreneurial, and he is an artist on many levels in that regard.
Yes.
And he's just out there stirring things up. And that's probably why we got over 300 entries this year. That's fantastic. So what's happening for the to make the 75th annual exhibit special?
So on September 16th, we're having our awards ceremony from 1 to 3. But before that, we're having a special 75th anniversary brunch at the center, which their brunch is fantastic. And tickets for that are $75. But the brunch will be really fun just to kind of celebrate 75 years and have some good foods and endless mimosas and, and whatnot. So.
Exactly. And Bloody Marys.
And Bloody Marys.
Bloody Marys. I've ordered pictures of Bloody Marys. Yeah. Well, it's a little bit of a fundraiser for us. $75 is not what the brunch would usually cost. We're charging more because it is a fundraiser.
Yes.
But it will help support the exhibit.
Yes.
And help to, because we do have to raise money every year for, because we give away $10,000 in prizes, which is a big deal.
And that's always like such a fun part of the award ceremony too, just to see all the artists that are involved. It's kind of like a fun networking event because you have just so many artists there and so many prizes to give out, and it's just a fun day in general.
So we have information about the brunch and the show on our website, SouthShoreArtsOnline.org.
Yes.
We have such a long name. Or 219-836-1839, extension 101.
Yes.
Is it 101?
Yes, I believe so.
No, it's 100. Extension 100. That's like the operator. That's Leona.
Okay.
So thank you, Bridget. And it'll be fun to see all the people who come out for the brunch and the Salon Show.
Yes, I'm excited.
Okay, thanks. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And if you happen to miss any part of this Eye on the Arts conversation, you can catch all of the Eye on the Arts conversations every day on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. Thank you for being with us today on the program, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.